excited about our next speaker.
Terry
McDonald is adjunct scholar at the Institute for Educational Freedom. She's a senior education fellow at the Foundation for Economic Freedom and author of Unschooled, Raising Curious, Well-Educated Children Outside the Conventional Classroom. Her research interests include homeschooling and alternatives to homeschooling, self-directed learning, education entrepreneurship and innovation, parent empowerment, school choice, and family and child policy. She has articles published in The Wall Street Journal, Newsweek, NPR, Education Next, Reason Magazine, City Journal, and Entrepreneur, just to name a few. She has a bachelor's degree in economics from Bowdoin College and a master's degree in education policy from Harvard University. She is generously taking time away from her husband and four kids in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Please join me in welcoming Terry McDonald.
Good evening, everyone. It is such a delight to be with you in person for your wonderful convention. It's such a great thrill. And I'm particularly happy to be the warm-up act for Jim Bovard. So as Crystal mentioned, I'm the Senior Education Fellow at the Foundation for Economic Education, FEE.org. As I'm sure many of you know, FEE is the country's oldest libertarian think tank, founded in 1946 by Leonard Reed, celebrating our 75th anniversary this year. Founded at a similarly fraught time, so I think a lot of the work we're doing is quite relevant for a year of lockdown. I'm also an adjunct scholar at Cato and the author, as Crystal mentioned, of Unschooled, Raising Curious, Well-Educated Children Outside the Conventional Classroom that was published in the spring of 2019, but had quite a bit more sales in the spring of 2020 as all of a sudden so many families found themselves suddenly living and learning at home with their children. I don't think it's hyperbole to say that education will never be the same again after this year. With lockdowns, school closures, and related pandemic policies, families have glimpsed a new way of living and learning. They're frustrated with teachers' unions and other kinds of school reopening delays and unpredictability. And they have much more support now for school choice and education choice mechanisms. So I think it's fair to say that the changes we've encountered over the last year with education are here to stay. They'll be long-lasting. So I'm going to take us through a year in review of what has occurred over the past 12 months or so and where we are now and where I think we're going. Can you hear me okay with this?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, good. And I'm going to be focusing on K-12 schooling mostly. There's certainly been disruption in the higher education space as well. I think those changes will also be long-lasting, but I'm going to be focusing on K-12 schooling primarily. Okay, so let's go all the way back to last March, where we suddenly were finding ourselves in what I call the world homeschooling moment in my article for Forbes back on March 11th of 2020. Now, this is a time where at the peak of the school closures and the lockdowns last spring, we had around 50 million U.S. K-12 students suddenly displaced from their classrooms. And globally, that was 1.5 billion students, again, at the peak of lockdowns last spring. So those of us who homeschooled before the pandemic, before the shutdown, will tell you that this really was nothing like typical homeschooling. We were all isolated and cut off from our communities and our friends and family members and classes. So it was just as hard for those of us who were used to not learning inside a classroom than for the family, as well as for the families who were accustomed to being in a conventional classroom. A challenging time for everybody. But I do think that it gave families for the first time maybe an understanding of education outside of a traditional setting and what that might look like, even as atrocious as district Zoom schooling was in the beginning and continued to be. It at least started them thinking about alternatives to conventional learning models. And so sure enough, in April of last year, EdChoice came out with one of the first surveys asking parents, hey, you know, what are your impressions of education and parenting and public policy in the wake of these school shutdowns and lockdowns? And they found that more than half, 55% of the parents who responded to their survey had a more favorable view of homeschooling in light of the school shutdowns than they did pre-pandemic. And I said, gosh, you know, if you have this many families who think homeschooling is good under these circumstances, when we're completely isolated from our communities and cut off from any kind of social interaction, just wait till you see the real thing, when museums are open, libraries are open, classes are happening, and so on. But still, it was an indicator of what would come over the following months. Now, also at this time, some of you might have heard this story coming out of 2020, the timing couldn't have been better. Harvard Law School professor Elizabeth Bartholet made a splash when she called for a presumptive ban on homeschooling. And this came out in the May-June issue of Harvard Magazine, which came out at the end of April of last year. Looking at her research and her recommendations for a presumptive ban, wanting essentially a German model to be imported here, where we'd have a flat-out national ban of homeschooling. So, now to be fair, Professor Bartholet published her recommendations and suggestions a couple of months prior to the school closures in the Arizona Law Review piece, in an in-depth piece where she talked about how we should have this, again, presumptive ban on homeschooling, and in the odd case where parents would be given permission by the state to homeschool their kids, they would still have to have their kids take classes each week at the local district school. They would have to endure periodic home visits by government officials. They would have to continue to take standardized tests by the district and the state. So it was quite authoritarian. And what a great, for me, a personal high of 2020 was being able to debate Professor Bartholet live in the middle of June of last year at the Cato Institute, really challenged her views and really what were outdated stereotypes of homeschooling that I think she really mischaracterized modern day homeschooling. So that was all happening as 60 million students were suddenly learning at home. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so then May and June of last year, we have another poll that comes out. This time, USA Today, Ipsos poll, giving a closer glimpse of what back to school might have been like or might be like last year. They found that 60% of parents said that they would not send their kids back to school for in-person learning, even if schools reopened for full-time in-person learning. Families saying they wanted to continue either with independent homeschooling or virtual Zoom schooling. And parents' reasons for this, I think, were twofold. There were certainly some parents who had concerns about the virus and the impact of the virus on their kids, but a lot of parents were more concerned about the virus response and the CDC guidelines that were being laid out for schools, including all-day mask wearing, social distancing, plexiglass around children's desks, eliminating the cafeteria, eliminating recess, no sharing toys, and so on. And I think a lot of parents said, well, we're not going to send our kids back to that. So started to see families choosing other options. As libertarians, we could acknowledge that a good bright spot from last spring was a loosening of compulsory schooling laws, compulsory attendance laws. A lot of states saying that schools didn't have to meet the 180-day requirement, that they could end their school years early, they could eliminate standardized testing, and so on. So that was a bright spot, but we'll see if that continues, and that could be a policy point for you all here. Another thing that came out not so bright from last year was virtual truancy. So you started getting stories about parents who were being investigated by Child Protective Services for their kids not logging on to Zoom school. They would have Child Protective Services come to their home and interrogate them. The Boston Globe did a really strong investigative report about this in the summer, looking back at the spring, interrogating these families. In many cases, the families didn't have Chromebooks or stable internet connection, and still they were being traumatized by Child Protective Services. Okay, so then we come to July. Now we're going to see if the polling results turn into actual action. And sure enough, the first week of July in North Carolina was the first week that parents could officially enroll their children as homeschoolers for the upcoming academic year. And so many parents signed their kids up to homeschool for the coming academic year that it crashed the state's website that first week of July. So that was a good sign. NPR also did a bunch of research throughout the month of July, finding homeschooling up 20, 25, 30% in various states in terms of homeschool applications for fall. Another thing that came out in July, and I think is here to stay, are these pandemic pods, or these learning pods that began to sprout. So this is when families got together and realized that it was going to be a long year ahead. In many cases at this time, parents had noticed that their kids had no social interaction with other kids for the previous few months, and they wanted their kids to be interacting safely with other kids. So they developed these pods, which are really just sort of a timely twist on traditional homeschool co-ops, where parents and families got together, often through Facebook or other networks, and said, hey, let's get our kids together, let's take turns hosting a play group at our house, or maybe we hire a teacher or a tutor or a college student to facilitate or to supervise our kids. I talked to a lot of teachers who found this was a much more profitable opportunity for them. One ninth grade English teacher I interviewed in Illinois said she could make more money and have much more flexibility as a pod teacher than she could in her local district school, so she was planning to continue that. But of course, whenever we have these decentralized, spontaneous, parent-driven solutions to a challenging time, the government has to get involved, which they did with these pod regulations. And all of a sudden, states started listing out their guidelines for what pandemic pods could look like come fall, including things like the size and scope of your pod. In my state of Massachusetts, you couldn't change, money couldn't change hands between educators and parents. You couldn't pool money for snacks or supplies. You had to comply with health and safety requirements and get permission from your district. In some states, you had to register as a licensed daycare. So that was a problem. I will say that in many of these states, it was the parents that were mostly encountering these pandemic pod regulations were parents who were going to continue to enroll their kids in the district schools and have the pandemic pod be an opportunity for kids to work together doing Zoom school, district Zoom schooling together in a small group. So the district was still kind of providing this oversight. And so my recommendation at the time and continues today is unenroll your kids from these government schools so you have much more freedom and flexibility to have a playgroup whenever you want it. All right. So August, we have a phenomenal Gallup poll that comes out saying that the homeschool rate has doubled from pre-pandemic rates. They estimate about 10% of the U.S. K-12 school-age population would be homeschooling for the 2020-2021 academic year. They found plummeting rates of parent satisfaction towards the public schools. They saw a drop in public school enrollment by 7%, which was enormous compared to the year before. And this was also a time when the teachers' unions really started pushing around their weight and saying, you know, we're not going to reopen until some of our demands are met. And some of you may remember the Los Angeles Teachers Union notoriously said, you know, we're not going to open until these particular requirements are met, some of which were PPE and virus-related issues. But they also said they wouldn't consider reopening until we passed Medicare for All at the federal level. We had universal housing. We had raised taxes at the state level in California. Defunded the police and put a moratorium on charter schools. So this was the time I think a lot of parents said, gee, you know, the teachers' unions are a lot more ideologically focused, a lot more political than they may have thought previously, and that maybe also started them thinking about some other options for their kids' education. certainly realizing that the teachers unions were playing a huge part in whether or not schools reopened. All right, so back to school time in September. We definitely see that there's this exodus from district schools, that the Gallup polling is turning out to be correct. School choice support starts to really soar. So Real Clear Opinion Research found that between April and September, support for school choice mechanisms like education savings accounts, vouchers, tax credit scholarship programs, and so on, increased 10% to 77% of respondents saying they support school choice. And many parents who had never before thought about school choice or any of these policies suddenly had an increased interest, saying, you know, gee, why are our schools getting fully funded when they're closed and when they're not meeting our student or family needs? So that starts to happen. And then we get increasing data coming in about lockdown harms in terms of mental health, not only for adults, but for kids as well. The CDC reporting in August that 1 in 4 young adults seriously contemplated suicide last June. So, you know, serious harms coming from lockdown policies. And, you know, it was definitely a push to get schools reopened, but I would argue that a lot of this came from just isolation of kids just not being able to be with other kids, whether they're in school or out of school. Activities were still closed, youth sports were still not happening, extracurricular activities weren't occurring, the libraries and museums were still closed. So certainly social isolation for everyone was a big issue. All right, October. Brown economist Emily Oster wrote a great piece in The Atlantic saying, look, schools are not super spreader events. They're not super spreader places. Why are they shut down? Teachers are at no more risk for COVID than any other profession. There's no reason why they should be closed, but still they remain closed. A bright spot from October was the Wall Street Journal finding that people were starting businesses in the second quarter at the fastest rate or the highest rate that they had in over a decade. So there was some great entrepreneurship happening, including in the education space. I profiled a couple of entrepreneurs. One is Michael Strong, who runs an online school for middle school and high schoolers based out of Austin, but it's a national school. He's a longtime libertarian and education entrepreneur who had planned to do something like this down the road, and the pandemic really accelerated it for him. So some great entrepreneurship happening. All right. So we had the Gallup poll in August. Then in Education Week, in November, Education Week came out with a report finding that homeschooling had risen to 9%. So remember, the Gallup poll said that 10% of U.S. K-12 students were homeschooling this year. Education Week finding that number to be 9%. And one of the really interesting pieces of the Education Week survey was it found that the increase in homeschooling this year was driven mostly by low-income families. So there's this myth, even before the pandemic, that it's affluent, privileged families, upper middle class families who are homeschooling. And that was never the case. In fact, to its credit, the New York Times pointed this out last fall, saying even before the pandemic, homeschooling families were on average less affluent than their school peers. And sure enough, the increase in the homeschooling population during the pandemic was being led by low-income families. So there was this exodus towards private schools as well as toward homeschooling, and for a lot of families, homeschooling was a more cost-effective option. You saw that in November, NPR reporting public kindergarten enrollment down 16% nationwide, families just not enrolling their kids into public kindergarten or choosing private options. And overall, public K-12 enrollment was down by at least 2%. Gallup suggesting down 7%. In Arizona, it was down 5%. In Massachusetts, it was down 4%. So somewhere between 2 and 7% decline in overall public school enrollment this academic year. All right. Now, I think one of the real tragedies that's come out of this year in education and the pandemic response and school closures is it's given remote learning or virtual learning a bad name. And I think you really should try to avoid that tendency to think of virtual learning as something that's subpar. Virtual district Zoom schooling is certainly subpar, right? We've had record numbers of failures, and you're kind of getting teachers who've never been trained to be remote educators now teaching an in-class
curriculum to students in their homes, and that's been a disaster for many students. But there's really high quality, in many cases, private online learning options that are doing a great job, that met families' needs, that are seeing increased enrollment and increased sales. I think of Stride K-12 Inc., for example, which is one of the leading providers of online education. Arizona State University Digital Prep is another charter school network out of Arizona that also provides national virtual learning, really high quality. So I hope we can still have a lot of faith in virtual education and separate it from the Zoom schooling that some of our kids are experiencing. All right, we're getting up to the current time, but starting in the new year, 2021, surprise, surprise, teachers' unions are still blocking reopening plans. The majority of kids, even at the beginning of the new calendar year, were not in full-time in-person learning. Today, it's still only 40% of students are actually in full-time in-person learning in the U.S. And it's in large part due to teachers' unions halting these reopening plans. Information came out, research came out, for example, by Brown University researchers finding that school reopenings had nothing to do with community virus spread or concerns about outbreaks in a particular community, and had everything to do with the strength and influence of the local teachers' union. And other research has backed that up. Interestingly, this Brown University research also found that in counties that had high numbers of Catholic schools, which were more likely to open for in-person learning this year than district schools, in those counties, public schools were more likely to reopen, showing the power of competition in education. So a good tidbit there. Okay, so remember back in March of 2020, I told you that EdChoice found that 55% of parents had a more favorable view of homeschooling in light of the pandemic, or since the beginning of the pandemic. In February, that number was up to 63% by EdChoice. So again, families finding a new way of learning outside of a conventional schooling to be valuable. And this is still at a time when a lot of things are still closed. I know where I am, my library is still closed, classes aren't occurring, museum just reopened recently. So this is still quite a lockdown experience for a lot of us. And yet, parents' impressions of alternatives to school are growing. All right, last March, we had another really amazing survey. So we had the Gallup survey in August showing increasing homeschooling rates, then the Education Week survey in November showing increasing homeschooling rates, and then in March, the U.S. Census Bureau came out showing that the homeschooling rate had tripled, more than tripled, from pre-pandemic rates. So what they found was, of course, federal data showing that pre-pandemic, the most recent federal data we have, shows about 3.5% of the U.S. K-12 school population is homeschooled, about 1.7 million students. The Census Bureau found that last April, that number was up to about 5%. And when they did the study again in the fall, they said that that went up to 11.1% of U.S. K-12 students are being homeschooled this year. It was about 5.7 million students, which is roughly on par with the number of private school students that we have in the U.S. So tremendous gains. And the really fascinating thing about the U.S. Census Bureau data is it found a fivefold increase in the number of black homeschooling families. Now, the rate of black homeschoolers had already been increasing pre-pandemic. It had doubled between 2008 and 2012, but was still underrepresented compared to the overall distribution in the larger K-12 school-age population. The Census Bureau now finds an overrepresentation of black homeschoolers. So over 16% of the homeschool population are black students, compared to about 15% in the K-12 public school population. And the Census Bureau also found increasing rates of homeschooling in all racial and ethnic backgrounds. Hispanic homeschoolers had already been roughly on par with the demographics in the larger K-12 school age population, but everybody saw gains this time. All right, so here we are. Here we are in April. You know, next year I think is going to look a lot like this year. I think, we're already hearing that school districts are saying the cafeteria is still going to be closed. Extracurricular activities and school sports might not be happening in many districts. There's still going to be all-day mask wearing and social distancing. And I think a lot of parents are saying, I'm not sure I want that for my kids next year. And are continuing to look for other options, particularly for younger children. So New York City came out with data last week showing that kindergarten applications for this coming fall are down 12% compared to 9% for last year. Now, some of that could be families fleeing locked down New York for districts that have open schools or for private schools, but I think either way we're going to see a dip again in certainly kindergarten enrollment, and I would say overall public school enrollment. And that's where parents are heading to learning pods and homeschooling and virtual high-quality learning, not Zoom school, and other private options. But I think we'll continue to gain traction. So, yeah, I don't think education will ever be the same. I think for the first time, parents have been back in charge of their children's education in ways unimaginable before the pandemic. They've, in many cases, got a front row seat to what their children are learning or are not learning in Zoom school. And they're not impressed in many cases and are looking for change and feel re-empowered. The teachers' unions, I think, have really overplayed their hands, and I think a lot of parents are realizing that there's more to their agenda than teacher benefits and student success, that they really have much more of a political agenda. And so I think the government school monopoly is weakening. And I think, again, this education, innovation, and entrepreneurship, these new learning models like learning pods and micro school networks and different virtual learning options, I think, are really expanding solutions for families and creating some more options. And another bright spot is that, again, there's been so much increased support of school choice legislation and choice policies that we now have active school choice legislation in over 2,000 states. I think it might be up to 30 states now, including here in Maryland. You have two bills currently.
Yeah,
two House bills currently in committee. So they were.
We have a lot of work to do.
So they were introduced. The first one, HB 939, was designed to offer grants to students whose local school district was closed for in-person learning to provide a grant for students to go to an open private school. And HB 1113 aims to create the first ever education savings account for Maryland. Yeah, so that's a promising one. And education savings accounts, for those of you that might not be familiar with it, they work similar to vouchers in terms of giving some per pupil expenditure back to the students and having the money follow students, not systems. But they broaden the definition of education beyond schooling. So they include expenses for books and materials and tutoring, maybe some odd school therapies, as well as tuition. So much broader definition of education with the education savings account. So more flexibility than just school tuition. So in terms of lasting impact, I think we have certainly seen gains in parent empowerment, as I mentioned. I don't think that's going anywhere. Parents really feel emboldened. They have these new perspectives on education so that they realize schooling doesn't have to take place necessarily in a conventional classroom. And new possibilities. So the Brookings Institution, for example, came out with a report finding that teleworking, working from home, wasn't going to go anywhere after the pandemic. A lot of people were going to continue to work from home. And I think because many adults have much more freedom and flexibility in their own work life, they want to be able to grant that same freedom and flexibility to their kids in terms of learning, and now might have the ability to facilitate education at home or in conjunction with some of these virtual learning options or hybrid models or learning pods. I think parents realize they don't have to be the ones sitting around the kitchen table directing a child's learning or going through textbooks with their kids, that there's so many resources available to them. So that's a big change. And then, of course, these policies, school choice policies, that hopefully you all can help support as part of the Libertarian Party here to really make sure that there's meaningful change that expands education options for many more families. I think that's a big change. So I'll end with a final story and then open up for questions and then turn it over to Jim.
Yes.
But one of the interesting historical notes, and I think it's relevant now for talking about COVID-19 and education, is back when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans in 2005, it really decimated the city. And with the physical destruction of the city, it also loosened a lot of the bureaucratic structures and institutional constraints that had existed in the school district. And Stanford professor Terry Moe wrote a book in 2019 called The Politics of Institutional Reform, where he really goes in depth into what happened in New Orleans in the wake of Katrina. And he argues that it was really Katrina and that natural kind of devastation that occurred in that area that led to now New Orleans being an entirely 100% all charter school district for students there. Yeah, huge, huge success.
We need a hurricane.
And with it. And with that shift to all charter schools, they're also seeing really phenomenal academic gains as well, just by being able to loosen some of that bureaucratic and institutional control. So I think the same is true. You know, you say we need a hurricane, but I think, in fact, the last year has been like a hurricane. And I think we're going to see the same kinds of loosening on the monopoly system of government schooling and hopefully many more years of positive change. So that is it for me. I hope you'll visit me at c.org/Terry and connect with me there. Minutes for questions. Yeah, Dan.
Is there any data right now on different styles of homeschooling and efficacy? Is there anything that people are looking at and say, oh, it's really working, or any numbers like that? Is anybody doing?
That's a good point. No, that would be a good study to do. We know pre-pandemic, based on peer-reviewed studies as well as literature reviews, that homeschoolers generally outperform their school peers. They have no trouble getting into college. They perform well in college. So we would assume that that would be the case now. And of course, there's a lot of correlation between parental involvement and education success, and so that's sort of the number one piece there. But that would be a really great research project, yeah. Yeah.
No, I considered homeschooling, but I didn't consider myself competent enough. I didn't have the resources. How can I get to a seminar on how to do school homeschooling for those in Maryland that want to do it?
Yeah, you know, I'm sure there are lots of resources for families in Maryland, and I think there's some homeschoolers here in the audience. Yeah, I was going to say Crystal and Valerie could probably talk about some of the resources that are available here. There's Facebook groups to connect with and other local networks. But the reality is that because there are so many more homeschoolers, even before the pandemic, but especially now, there's a lot of resources for homeschooling families so that it's not really the kind of stereotype of a parent, typically a mom, sitting around a kitchen table and going through textbooks. Now you have an assortment of, in many cases, low-cost or free curriculum. I think of, for example, Khan Academy, which is all free online video tutorials used in a lot of school classrooms across the country. They're particularly known for their math curriculum. They have really boosted a lot of their lesson plans and resources for families during the pandemic, and it's completely free. So, you know, there's just some really great resources out there for parents, and they can also create these pods or co-ops as well. Yeah? I'm not sure if this answers your question, but I think the school choice piece is a big deal. So I'm in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where many parents never really thought much about school choice. And all of a sudden, once the schools have been closed for months and months, parents start saying, oh, you know, why are the schools still getting all of this tax money? And yet my kids aren't there. And then there's these private schools, and they're open, and they're getting tuition money. And so I think it just started to get a lot of parents who previously hadn't thought about policy, in particular education policy, to start saying, you know, maybe there is something to this idea of having funding follow students instead of systems. And I think
It's happening.
I have sort of two questions. They're both kind of niche, so if I choose whichever one you like or ignore the most. One would be about, I'm a lacrosse coach, so spring sports just picked up. And a lot of kids are now working. So, and they don't have the time. They found that work ethic and they schedule, and they're like, I can't do this. So would you say that, is there any relationship between kids discovering this new realm where they can control their own education and their work life? How much employment has gone up among teenagers? Is there anything, or a correlation between those? And then the second question I have, I'm sorry, is the ESOL community, immigrant community, they get a lot of pressure because there's supposed lawyers will counsel them that they have to enroll in school, even if they're 18, 19, 20, enroll in the nearest high school because it'll help your immigration case. Is there anything about trying to help ESOL students get into the homeschool pipeline? Because they get all this pressure, but they're here to work. They're here to live and work, not to be students in a high school trapped, and they skip and all those things. Is there anything to help them or reach out to that pipeline and get them out of the pressure they get that you're not going to be a citizen if you don't enroll in this school and then skip class every day?
Yeah, two really good questions. I think the first question is the Bureau of Labor Statistics has found in recent years that teen employment has plummeted, that students are spending much more time in school at all ages, and especially teens, and they're working less. And so they're not gaining that on-the-job experience or just that other perspective aside from academics that can really help them to develop and have a better pathway towards adulthood. So that would be interesting. I don't know about, and during the pandemic, of course, we have lots of states passing increased minimum wage laws, which only can serve to hinder teen employment and prevent teens from getting the kinds of on-the-job experience they need. So that in combination with shutdowns and so on, I think, has probably hurt teen employment, but hopefully we'll see that rebound this summer as well.
So anecdotally, I think it'll go up.
Oh, great.
Like, there's lots of kids working that don't have time for sports.
I will say that there, anecdotally again, have been stories about teens becoming much more entrepreneurial during the pandemic, being able to spot needs in their neighborhood, maybe grocery delivery or babysitting for their neighbors who are trying to work and have their kids at home, or other kinds of entrepreneurial endeavors. So some good opportunities there. I think that ties in with maybe answering your second piece too, is encouraging more apprenticeship programs for immigrant communities and job training and entrepreneurship. I don't have data for you on those older immigrants and how they can potentially get out of that net.
Using the immigration system to pressure kids in a way that this connects two issues that libertarians are concerned, you know. I'm curious, like, is there any way to get kids out of that?
No, I agree with you. I think that that's the right approach in thinking about ways to, and I think, again, it comes from the private sector and nonprofits and business owners and so on. Yeah.
Two questions. First, your opponent at Cato, did she understand that the German government school system is a very authoritarian system?
Oh, yeah.
And it's tracking. And you have to get certain grades in order to get into the better school.
Otherwise,
you don't. There's no choice.
Yeah, so this is, we're talking about Harvard Law School professor Elizabeth Bartlett, again, who called for the presumptive ban on homeschooling, wants us to have a national ban similar to Germany. Which has been in place since 1930. You know, I argued that her presumptive ban on homeschooling really was just a straw man in what I think is a much larger, more pernicious effort to erode parental rights, individual freedom, education choice. I mean, she's very honest in her 40-page Arizona Law Review piece that she considers the U.S. Constitution outdated and inadequate, in her words, and she would like us to move from a negative rights interpretation of the Constitution, where our rights precede government, to positive rights, more of the European model, where the government grants us our liberty.
My second question relates to the teaching unions. Obviously, they think their primary job is to protect teachers. Education is a secondary consideration. Did they realize, at least as an unintended consequence, that they're going to reinforce homeschooling and hurt themselves by not wanting to go back to school?
You would think they would start to figure this out, yeah. I don't know. They're holding strong. I mean, the Los Angeles schools just reopened a couple weeks ago for the first time in over a year, but not until they got the school district to concede to offering child care subsidies for teachers with young children. So they're still plowing ahead with policies that I think in the end are really going to backfire on them. I agree. Yeah, Crystal.
You talked a little bit about, the question was asked earlier about
Yeah, so the book, my unschool book, really tries to separate education from schooling, including school-at-home versions of homeschooling, which is what a lot of families, I think, encountered certainly last spring when they suddenly just changed the location of the schooling from the classroom to the living room, but it was still very much replicating everything we think of with conventional schooling. And so the book goes into the idea of self-directed education, providing a lot more freedom and autonomy, opportunities for self-determination for kids. And I spotlight a lot of unschooling families, unschooling alumni, as well as the entrepreneurs creating self-directed learning centers for these unschoolers that allow young people to attend a couple days a week or even 5 days a week as registered homeschoolers, but able to learn in a much more self-directed way that doesn't replicate school at home. Yeah.
So what do you say for the family that can't afford the money or the time for homeschool or private school their children? What would you say to get the kids out of that homeschool system without the time or the monetary resources?
Yeah, I mean, I think that these learning pods have really expanded the ideas of microschool networks that were starting to gain some traction prior to the pandemic. And these can be really low-cost models. I mean, you can imagine a situation where you get a bunch of families together and you all sort of take turns facilitating a curriculum or supervising kids, or you get a college student. In one of my recent articles, I talk about a family, I think they were in Virginia, that created a pod network, and it's with, I think, five or six families, and it's about $1,000 a month, so not free, but low cost in many cases compared to other private options, and that's something to think about too. And I think that's why we also should be pushing for school choice policies, education choice policies that redistribute that, at least pre-pandemic, $700 billion every year in U.S. taxpayer funding of K-12 public schools, and redistribute that away from public school systems into families. Of course, as libertarians, we would like to get that number down. So many of us would say, you know, we have to reduce overall school funding, but as long as we have it there, let's put it back in the hand of families instead of systems. Any other questions? Great. It's been such a pleasure being with you all today. Thank you so much.